Support for WPR comes from Viterbo University, offering online bachelor completion programs, including business, education, nursing, and more. Information is available at viterbo.edu/completion.
Support for WPR comes from the Dram Corporation, sustainable producers of OMRI-listed fertilizers for organic gardening and farming. Made in Algoma, Wisconsin. More information is at dramm.com.
Good morning. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Joy Cardine. Happy to have you along on this Tuesday, September the 11th. It's coming up on 10 minutes past 7 o'clock. We will talk with the skeptical environmentalist this hour. He is Bjørn Lomborg, and he is the author of the 2001 best-selling book, The Skeptical Environmentalist, and he also has a brand new book out right now. It's called Cool It, The Skeptical Environmentalist's Guide to Global Warming. 1-800-642-1234 in Madison, 263-1890. Our numbers if you'd like to join in the conversation or send an email to talk@wpr.org. Our guest says that global warming, first of all, is real. However, he believes that the effects of global warming are exaggerated, and that there's two, and the way that it's talked about is also more heated than it needs to be. We will welcome your thoughts and questions on this for our guest during the hour. Bjørn Lomborg was named one of the 100 most influential people in the world by Time magazine in 2004. He is an adjunct professor at the Copenhagen Business School. He is the author of Cool It, The Skeptical Environmentalist's Guide to Global Warming. And he joins us by telephone, I believe, in Denver. Is that right?
Hi, Joy. No, I'm actually still in New York.
Oh, you are?
I'm flying out to Denver later today.
All right. Well, welcome. So what does Cool It refer to?
Well, it refers both to the point, of course, that we need to actually find a way to deal with climate change over the long term. We need to fix climate change within this century and stop emitting carbon emissions. On the other hand, it also, of course, refers to the fact that right now the debate is so heated and we're all running around screaming that we really don't have a good sense of what should we do. We don't have a sense of that this is a policy that will have to span both generations, continents, and political parties if we're going to find a solution that will actually fix climate change throughout the century.
Now, how critical is it that we fix it by the end of the century?
Well, it's definitely one of the problems that we have in the 21st century, and it is a problem that we need to fix. On the other hand, we also have to get a sense understanding of the size and the magnitude of this. This is not something that we can fix within the next 5, 10, or 15 years. International Energy Agency that advises governments, for instance, tell us that right now we use about 13% of the global energy comes from renewables, mainly biomass and water. And if we don't do anything by 2030, it'll be up to 14%, you know, just the business as usual. But if we really engage in a long and big scale effort to combat climate change, what they say is instead of reaching 14% by 2030, they tell us we can reach all the way up to 16%. Mm-hmm. And that's my point, to say this is not something that we're going to solve by 2030. This is something that we need to find solutions for come 2050. And that's very much about providing much cheaper technologies for our kids and grandkids, and also for China and India and all the other nations that, quite frankly, have much more important priorities right now than fixing climate change. But we need to make sure that there's technology available for them so that they can fix it very cost-effectively come 2050.
Yeah. You believe that some of the consequences of global warming are exaggerated, like the deaths of polar bears?
It's important that we tend to hear stories that are only negatively slanted. It's important also to say that climate change is overall negative, but it's unlikely that we have a good basis for making sound policy judgment if we only hear a very one-sided story. Let me give you two examples. When we talk, for instance, of temperature rising, we very often hear that this will mean more heat deaths. And that's absolutely true. We're going to see more heat waves and consequently more heat death. In the U.S., it's probably estimated that in 2050, you're going to see another 40,000 people dying from heat waves due to climate change, due to global warming. But you also need to hear the fact that because temperatures are rising, we're going to see fewer cold waves and hence fewer cold deaths. And since cold deaths typically outweigh heat deaths vastly mm-hmm. in virtually all places of the world, that means about 220,000 fewer deaths from cold in the U.S. You both need to hear that there's 40,000 more, but also that there's 220,000 less. And when you talk about the polar bears, as you said, it's true. Polar bears will be negatively affected by climate change. It's important to say that there are many other things that also affect them. The species has probably increased from about 5,000 of the global population in the 1960s to about 22,000 now, mainly because we've regulated hunting. But the point that I try to make is that because we constantly talk about climate change, we perhaps miss the best ways to deal with polar bears. The example here again is, if we assume that polar bears are as affected by climate change as being claimed, if we do the Kyoto Protocol, we can probably save about one polar bear per year. And I'm simply pointing out, isn't it curious that we worry so much about saving that one polar bear at a cost of trillions of dollars when we neglect the fact that every year we shoot about 1,000 polar bears? Shouldn't we first start thinking about stopping shooting 1,000 polar bears before we worry about saving one?
We'll think about that as we check our weather forecast, and then we will continue talking with Bjorn Lomborg, who is the author of Cool It, The Skeptical Environmentalist's Guide to Global Warming. 1-800-642-1234 in Madison, 263-1890. What questions do you have for him? I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Joy Cardine. Good to have you with us. Hope you stay tuned. Right now it's 18, coming up on 18 minutes past 7 o'clock on this Tuesday, September the 11th. Coming up after 8 o'clock, I'll welcome in Frank Rich, columnist for the New York Times and author of The Greatest Story Ever Sold, about how the Bush administration sold us the Iraq War. We'll talk to him about some of the current issues in the news today about the Iraq War, including General Petraeus's testimony yesterday before Congress. Right now, we're looking at global warming with a guest who says global warming is real, but its effects are exaggerated. And we wonder what you think, what questions you have for the skeptical environmentalist. He's also the author of that 2001 bestseller. 1-800-642-1234 in Madison, 263-1890. Bjorn Lomborg is our guest. And I'm wondering if you, when you wrote The Skeptical Environmentalist, you ended up receiving a lot of flack from environmentalists who thought you were a traitor, right?
Yeah, I mean, the point that I try to make both with The Skeptical Environmentalist and with the new book, Cool It, is really to say we need to have a sense of proportion. In The Skeptical Environmentalist, for instance, I pointed out how we worry intensively, for instance, about pesticide residues, which probably kill very few people and quite plausibly has huge beneficial effects because it makes fruits and vegetables very cheap, which means that we have less cancer, whereas we worry fairly little about particular air pollution, for instance, which has much graver consequences, although it's gone down dramatically. It's probably the most important environmental issue for the U.S., still killing about 110,000 people each year. So I simply try to say we shouldn't necessarily be guided by the stories that look the meanest or the scariest on TV. We should actually take a look at the substance and say, well, where are the most important issues? And that's the same message that I carry over in the climate change debate. We hear a lot of these stories about how dangerous some of these things are going to be. And, of course, one of the main examples is the idea that climate change is going to worsen malaria. That's probably true. In a very technical sense, malaria is probably weakly related to temperature. So by the end of the century, we'll probably see a little more malaria. We estimate it's going to be about 3.2% more malaria. And if we do something about it, for instance, the Kyoto Protocol, we can probably cut malaria incidence by about 0.2%. But the curious question that I have then is, why is it we're so concerned about doing something about 0.2% of malaria and so fairly unconcerned about the 100% that's already there right now that we could do something about much cheaper? The point simply is, if we do the Kyoto Protocol, we can save about 1,400 people every year throughout the century from dying from malaria. That'd be great. But for 1/60th of the cost, we could save 850,000 people from dying every year throughout the century. It's simply a question of saying, for every time you save one person through climate change policies, for the same amount of money, you could actually have saved 36,000 people had you just dealt with it directly through malaria. So again, it's about cooling the conversation and understanding climate change is one problem, but it is only one problem of the many that we face in the 21st century.
Yeah. You are not a climate scientist, are you?
No. No, I'm a social scientist, and that's very important to say. I totally accept the UN Climate Panel, which is our best understanding of what climate is going to what climate is going to do. But what I say is, now we need to have a conversation about how do we deal with climate change. What kind of strategies are we going to use? That is the economic and social discussion that we need to have now about climate change, compared to all the other problems that are also out there and that we presumably also want to fix.
I'll go to the phones for you. Scott in Green Bay joins us first. Hi, Scott. You're on the air.
Good morning. I just wondered if your guest could comment on the theory regarding global warming being a cyclical event. I mean, it seems like, I know they say there's a consensus, I believe it's man-made, but you really can't have science when you have consensus, because science isn't about consensus, it's about fact. But that global warming is more of a cyclical event, and the Earth goes through warming and cooling periods throughout different millennia. You know, and the unfortunate thing is your guest talks about these issues and about getting ridiculed. That's the problem with the global warming debate. We can't have divergent opinions. I mean, it's almost become a religion, global warming, the concept of it. And it'd be nice if we could just have a good, healthy discussion without people being called global warming deniers like they're Holocaust deniers.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. What do you say about that?
Well, I mean, it's absolutely true. I mean, science is not driven by consensus, and we need to have people constantly questioning ourselves. And once we get too comfortable, obviously, that's an indication that we're probably rather talking about political consensus than a real consensus. And it's also important to say that, yes, the Earth climate has always been cyclical. We've just come out of a little ice age, which means that we would expect to see some temperature increase. But the point is that the vast majority of scientists are telling us that over and beyond the natural cyclical behavior, we are also seeing now a clear sign of man-made global warming. That is, that we are adding more warming simply because we're putting out CO2, and I think that's fairly uncontroversial. Now, your caller, Scott, might be right that in 10 or 20 years, we will think differently about this, but my point is simply to say, right now, this is what all the world's best, or virtually all of the world's best scientists is telling us, and consequently, we should take that into account and say, okay, given that climate is warming, given that we are certainly causing part of it, how should we react? To what extent should we do something about it? And what is it we should do? And that's the starting point that I take.
Yeah. What is it that should be done about it, as far as you're concerned?
Yeah. The point that I really try to make in the book is to say, most people talk about we need to cut emissions right now. That's what the Kyoto Protocol is about. That's what most people who talk about Kyoto 2 is talking about. It's about cutting emissions right now, and especially in the first world. It makes us feel good. It makes us feel like we're addressing the problem. The problem with this whole approach is, though, it costs a lot and does fairly little good. If you take the Kyoto Protocol, it would probably cost about $180 billion every year, yet it would only postpone global warming by the end of the century by about 5 years. So it would do fairly little at very high cost. And the point I say is, it's not about cutting emissions right now. It's about making sure that we can cut dramatically come mid-century. Because the basic problem with what we do right now is we cut in the rich world because we want to feel good, but the poor world, China and India and everyone else, don't want to do this because they have many other more important issues like feeding their kids or curing them from infectious diseases or giving them an education. And so what we need to focus much more on is to invest in research and development so that we can get much better technologies. Right now, solar panels are not effective. People will put up one to make, you know, to show off how good they are, but they'll not actually have solar panels covering their entire energy consumption because it's expensive, and this will only be in the first world. Let's make solar panels much cheaper so that people will simply put them up because they're effective, because they're a great way to get energy. And that, of course, not just goes with solar panels, but also wind power, but also carbon capture and energy efficiency and the many other technologies that potentially are out there.
Tom in Viroqua is with us now. Hi, Tom. You're on the air.
Yes, good morning. To say we should go slow, I think, is ludicrous. I've been involved with energy efficiency and conservation since 1974. I've been aware of global warming since the early 80s. If we had followed the precepts and the guidelines that were first instituted during the Carter administration, we'd essentially be where your guest wants us to be right now. And to say it's an either-or, the only reason that solar panels are as cheap as they are now is because there has been a demand and a use and an application for them such that industry has come aboard. And I think this naysaying of saying, don't rush into it, don't invest, let's just do more research, is falling right into the hands of a president who barely even recognizes global warming as an existing thing. To say that the voices are shrill calling for global climate change measures now is ludicrous. It's only been the last couple of years that most people are even aware of this. This is a very new phenomenon, and the more energy we have both towards using and implementing our existing technologies and as a result developing and improving the efficiencies of these technologies is the only way we're going to get out of this problem.
Dr. Lomborg.
Yeah. I mean, I take your point, Tom, and I think you're right in saying that we could have done more. But I think we also need to then look very clearly at the problem and say, how come that since Carter, we've outlined all these things, we've known that we should do it, and yet we haven't done it? What we've actually seen is that the research and development budgets have dropped dramatically in all countries, not just the U.S., since the early 80s, and they've actually never been as low as they are now. And that, of course, is, I would argue, to a very large extent because we are focused very much on cutting emissions right now, which makes for a short-term game, which makes it into, and if you look at the Kyoto Protocol, it's clearly a tactical game of how can I squeeze myself under the requirements of the Kyoto Protocol over the next 5 years, 2008 to 2012. But honestly, and I also take that's your point when you talk about you've been working with this since the 70s, that this is a very long-term problem. Now, I would have loved if we fixed it back in the time of Carter, but we didn't. And so I think we need to ask ourselves, is the right way to go to focus very much on cutting emissions right now, or is it to make sure that we actually find a way that it becomes much cheaper to cut emissions? Because quite frankly, we're not going to get the Americans on board, we're not going to get the Europeans to do a lot, and we're definitely not going to get China and India to do anything.
We are talking with Bjorn Lomborg. He is author of Cool It, The Skeptical Environmentalist Guide to Global Warming. And we will check news from NPR and WPR and then take more questions for him at 1-800-642-1234 in Madison, 263-1890, or send an email to talk@wpr.org. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Joy Cardine. It's 7:36 on this Tuesday, September the 11th. Our guest writes in his new book, Cool It, that humanity has caused a substantial rise in atmospheric carbon dioxide levels over the past centuries, thereby contributing to global warming, is beyond debate. What is debatable, however, is whether hysteria and headlong spending on extravagant CO2 cutting programs at an unprecedented price is the only possible response. Such a course is especially debatable in a world where billions of people live in poverty, where millions die of curable diseases, and where these lives could be saved, society strengthened, and environments improved at a fraction of the cost. Our guest is Bjorn Lomborg, who is author of Cool It, The Skeptical Environmentalist Guide to Global Warming. And we welcome your questions for him. 1-800-642-1234 in Madison, 263-1890. Sharon in Shatek is with us next. Hello, you're on the air.
Thank you. Good morning.
Good morning.
Let me be the devil's advocate. I'm afraid that a book like yours and a stance like yours, although I think it's valid, I'm on the cusp of saying, well, I'll sell my SUV, I'll stop burning wood in my fireplace, I'll use less electricity, and I won't buy any more gadgets, I'll sell my boat, etc. If I'm on the tip of that, you're telling me I don't have to worry about it probably in my lifetime, and I should just go ahead and continue to make a bigger carbon footprint.
Sharon, I take your point again, and I think there is an argument to say that if we are not worried enough, we might end up not doing enough. On the other hand, I would also argue that there is a real risk of us being too worried, and let me give you two examples. One thing is the British Broadcasting Corporation, the BBC, actually had one of its reporters try to become ethical man for a year, where they asked this person, and he got his family in on it, to basically reduce his carbon footprint as much as he possibly could. He did much of the same things you talked about. He sold his car. They got rid of a lot of their gadgets. They insulated their house. They looked into organic burials and all kinds of sometimes a little weird things. And it was pretty strenuous. And he would document this every week on BBC. It was a real sacrifice. But he really also tried to do something. At the end of the year, they then looked back and said, okay, so how much did you actually cut? The answer was he cut 20% of his carbon footprint. And, of course, one of the things he did right after he'd finished was he'd actually, and he was very honest about this, had bought tickets for the whole family to Jamaica, which pretty much canceled the entire year's worth of hard work. And so my point is, there is something fundamentally problematic about assuming that this is something individuals can do. That we can do something, but it really is a question about changing the societal infrastructures and make sure that we have much better technologies available. The second metaphor I also wanted to impress on you is, do you remember bird flu a couple of years ago? We all worried intensely about it, and suddenly it just went away. We had worry fatigue, but the problem is bird flu hasn't gone away. If anything, it's probably a bigger risk now than it was 2 years ago. Yet because we worried so much about it, we ended up forgetting about it because we just simply got sick and tired of it. And I'm worried that climate change could have very much the same effect, that we worry very much about it now. But if this is a century-long problem, having this kind of overhype, this kind of over-worry is not likely to last, and we're actually likely to see a backlash, just as we've seen many times before. I mean, if you look at the American population, they were almost as worried about climate change both in 1988 and 1997 and 2001, yet we've sort of come back because we can't sustain this level of worry. So I want us to worry on a different level, but a more systematic level, where we actually do smart things that we can sustain, also through different party structures and with other countries, and especially, again, China and India, so that we can find solutions in the long term. So I take your point, but I also think if we're going to fix this problem, we really need to find a way that's not going to require us all to, you know, go back to the proverbial caves, perhaps not, but, you know, at least go to a very very, very far back in some of the ways that we typically consider ourselves very fortunate to have.
Well, I think that your point is valid, but there's some variables that I'm not sure you thoroughly understand, and that's human beings. It's a good point, and I'm glad that you wrote the book. But I think we need to also consider what can happen in the next 50 years. Thanks.
Thanks very much, Sharon, for the call. So you are telling Sharon and the rest of us who are thinking about trying to reduce our carbon footprint to not worry about it, or say, I mean, we don't have to go back to the caves to get a better, you know, fuel-efficient car or whatever else.
No, I'm saying it's fine. We should definitely, you know, it's great to change your light bulbs, to get a more efficient car, to be more aware of this issue. But we also got to realize that is not what's going to fix climate change because of two things. First of all, cutting our emissions a little, especially because we also got to realize it's only a fraction of the total population is going to do this, will not matter very much for the U.S. And quite frankly, even the U.S. and the EU is not going to matter much in the 21st century emissions. We are going to matter some, but the most important part of the emissions, by far the largest, is going to come from the increase in the developing world. And they have much more important priorities. And so what we need to do is to make sure that technology is available to these countries much cheaper than it is today if they're going to cut come 2050. And so this is not about saying we shouldn't do anything about it, but it is to say we need to honestly be smart about this and remember that this is a global problem that needs global solutions and honestly cheap solutions. Otherwise, it's just simply not going to happen.
Bill in Deerfield is with us now. Hi, Bill.
Hi. Well, I agree with everything you just said there, and so my comment is not going to address that 50 year down the road better technologies. But I think that if we took some of the $400 million we're spending a day in Iraq and put it into, you know, retrofitting old homes with better insulation and better windows, better door jams, we could reduce our need to go to war for oil, and we'd have a small marginal impact on global warming. And we'd, you know, maybe use some of that $400 million a day to look into these better technologies for better solar panels, hydrocarbon cars or whatever. Who knows? But that's just my comment.
Yeah. And could I just say something again?
Sure.
I think Bill has a good point, and that we definitely don't spend all of our money very very brightly right now. And the problem, of course, is that many times we have very different political views of what is smart or poor spending. And so I would love to be able to see some of that money from the Iraq war being liberated further in better uses. But, you know, I'm a Danish national, so that's not my job to tell you how to do that. But to the extent that we do get money liberated, we still also have to ask and honestly try to appraise the discussion of how can we then help making a better world. And that's one of the things I've been involved in the so-called Copenhagen Consensus, where we've asked some of the world's top economists to look at all the different problems in the world and say, where do we have great solutions and where do we only have mediocre solutions? Where are the best bang for the buck? And what they actually showed us was if we invest, for instance, in some of the other things that also need to be fixed, like HIV/AIDS or malnutrition or malaria, we could do immense amounts of good. We could basically, for every dollar we spend, for instance, on preventing HIV/AIDS in sub-Saharan Africa, we could do $40 worth of social good. We could actually help these people a lot, becoming much better societies, much more resilient societies, also societies that would be much better able to deal with climate change come 2100. So we got to remember that there are many things we need to solve. And while we need to fix climate change in the long run, I think we also have a moral responsibility to take upon ourselves some of the other and very huge challenges that we can fix very, very cheaply.
Our guest is Bjorn Lomborg. He is author of Cool It, The Skeptical Environmentalist Guide to Global Warming. He was named one of the 100 most influential people in the world by Time magazine in 2004. He's an adjunct professor at the Copenhagen Business School, and in 2004 he started the Copenhagen Consensus, a conference of top economists who come together to prioritize the best solutions for the world's greatest challenges. And he says, while global warming, human-caused global warming, is real, He says that the effects of it are often exaggerated, and the proposed solution is too one-sided. 1-800-642-1234 in Madison, 263-1890. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Joy Cardine. 12 minutes before 8 o'clock, coming up after 8, we'll welcome in Frank Rich, author of The Greatest Story Ever Sold, The Decline and Fall of Truth in Bush's America. That's coming up after 8. Right now, we're talking with Bjorn Lomborg. He is author of Cool It, The Skeptical Environmentalist Guide to Global Warming. Lots of callers, but I wanted to ask you, Dr. Lomborg, if you think Al Gore's Inconvenient Truth is responsible for all of us being hot and bothered over this issue.
I think you need to say two things about Al Gore. On one side, we really need to thank Al Gore for having put the argument so eloquently and the issue so clearly in front of the American public. I mean, we had a situation where there was very much a lot of people arguing, oh, it's all a hoax, it's all natural variation, don't worry about it. And I think he's effectively pointed out, no, it is human-made, and we really need to be concerned about this. So we should congratulate Al Gore on that. On the other hand, we also need to, admit that in trying to do so, he's probably also overreached to the extent that he's gone to the other side and gone from perhaps talking to hoax and now talking about a catastrophe or some sort of hysteria. And I think that's equally or at least also unhelpful. And so what I try to do is to stake out the middle ground and say, this is not a hoax. But it's not a catastrophe either. It is a problem, and one of the many problems we need to fix in the 21st century. Of course, the most famous one is the idea of sea level rise. Sea levels are absolutely going to rise because of temperature increasing. Water, as everything else, expands when it gets warmer, and that's the main reason why we're going to see sea level rise over the 21st century. It's estimated by the UN Climate Panel somewhere between 1/2 and 2 feet of sea level rise, most likely about 1 foot of sea level rise throughout the century. And that's a problem. But we also need to remember it's not the 20 feet that the Al Gore film showed us, which would inundate much of Florida or New York or San Francisco. It's 1 foot. And to give a sense of context, the last 150 years, sea levels also rose about 1 foot. And yet it was not a civilization destroyer. It was a problem, and we definitely need to acknowledge that. And it's something that we'd rather not have happen. But it's not the end of civilization, and we need to be calm and have a more cool and rational discussion about this issue.
Judy in Reedstown is with us now. Hi, Judy. You're on the air.
Hi. I think a lot of modification of the presentation has gone by since I got on the phone, but I would like to agree with Tom of Viroqua. I don't know how many of you remember the long gasoline lines in the 70s, blocks and blocks in the cities. We already knew we were energy dependent then, and poor Carter was ridiculed for asking us to look into ways of saving energy, preserving it, and developing alternative sources for it. Basically, they laughed at him. What I'm worried about is that your plan asks us to wait to find a perfect balance and a perfect approach. I don't agree with the hysteria either, but I don't want to wait anymore. I think we need new science and money into research and lower cost devices, and I'm just concerned that you'll give us an excuse to move along moderately, and I hope that won't happen.
Yeah, and Judy, I again perfectly take your point, and I think what I'm trying to do is to make sure that we both have something that's sustainable in the sense that it will carry through the next 5, 10, 20, and 50 years and not just be another fad. It's absolutely essential that we do engage in making this research and development. But on the other hand, we also need to realize that if things are not efficient, that is, if things are not cost-effective, it's very hard to get people to accept them. In Denmark, where I come from, we actually put up a lot of windmills in the 70s, 80s, early 90s, and we felt incredibly good about ourselves. We felt very, very holy. But the point was, all of these windmills were essentially not effective. They only got up there because we subsidized them heavily and sometimes dramatically. And the problem is now windmills are actually effective, or just about now they're effective, and we basically have to cut down all of these windmills and put up new and effective ones. The point that I simply make is I would much rather have had that we spent a lot more of that money on research and development, making those windmills more effective sooner, and then only putting up the effective ones. Now, I'm talking broad terms. Of course, you need to have development copies. You need to have some up there for demonstration purposes and so on. But the main point here is, again, to say, let's not do something that just looks good and makes us feel good, but let's make sure that the things that we do, the things where we invest money, actually end up doing a lot of good. And that, I think, at the end of the day, we can only do if we make sure that they become effective so that people will not just put them on their rooftops or with solar cells or windmills to show off how good they are, but actually because they're effective, because people will want to, simply because our kids and grandkids will want to save money for no other reason. That's the way that we can get everybody, not just the good and nice people to do this, but everybody on this planet to follow along in this course.
Philip in Appleton is with us now. Good morning.
Good morning, and thank you for having Dr. Lomborg on. I watched your presentation on C-SPAN immediately after the Al Gore presentation. I guess that was probably about 6 months ago.
Yeah, that's.
And I think you were asked to speak, courtesy of Senator Inhofe, I believe.
This was for the House.
Okay. Yeah. But the interesting thing was that during the Al Gore presentation, I could hardly hear him because there were so many cameras clicking and so much media attention, and the lights were just flashing. He must have been almost blind. When you were asked to present your side of the argument, there was no media in there other than the C-SPAN cameras. And a C-SPAN watcher would have noted that, but however, the media, basically we get what we get, and people hear what they hear because the media chooses what to report on, what not to report on. And I'm just wondering if you are finally seeing, if you're getting more of these kinds of invites to bring out the rational side of things here and to talk about the consequences of overreacting to things, if you're getting more invitations to this sort of thing. To speak at more different places and to present the, the other side of the argument, but I guess the rest of the argument.
Mm. Well, I mean, Philip, obviously, the former vice president of the United States is in many ways more interesting than I am. so I don't blame the media for clicking away a little more. But yes, it is an important discussion to have, and I think there is a fair number of people who feel very interested about this. And I don't know if you've seen just today, there's a cover story on New York Times and on the New York Times science section on my book. And I think it's great that there is this discussion, and people are starting to wake up and say, if we are going to manage to do this, we really need to have a sensible conversation, not just run by hysteria, not just run by our fears, but actually having a good science-based conversation about how can we best address climate change. And I think, as we're seeing, take for instance Britain, which in many ways has probably been the most climate-scared country, they have had a huge amount of rhetoric since Blair came into power in 1997. They promised they were going to cut their carbon emissions by about 15%. Unfortunately, reality is a very hard thing to change, and what they've actually seen is that their carbon emissions have gone up by 3%. And what this shows is that a lot of leaders can come out and say all the good things that they want to do, but it doesn't make it true. And if we're going to do more than make believe, if we're actually going to manage to get our carbon economy turned around and eventually stop emitting carbon, have carbon emissions, we really need to find very cost-effective ways. And that's what I'm hoping I'm at least helping that debate to start.
Thanks, Philip, for the call. And one last call from Loretta in Wausau. Hi, you're on the air.
Hi. Yeah, my point is that I disagree with the statement that you made that the cheap fruits and vegetables were the benefit of that outweighed the use of herbicides and pesticides because people would get less cancer if they ate fruits and vegetables. And
no, from the research that was from the last book. So
from the research that I read, like Sandra, I forget her last name, living downstream, people living in rural areas, agricultural regions, have much higher rates of cancer because of...
Yeah, I'm sorry, Loretta, that kind of takes us off the subject of this book, which is global warming. Jeff in Madison, hi, you're on the air.
Hi. I think that in the United States, a lot of people still aren't using compact fluorescent light bulbs, and a lot of people still don't have their houses adequately insulated. Those are tangible things that we know are cost-effective that we can do. And, okay, maybe it only makes a few percentage difference, but if you look at compound interest, you know, 5% savings extrapolated over 100 years would be a substantial quantity of carbon dioxide. Mm-hmm. So I don't think our country anyway is at a point where we're so hyped up that we're doing irrational things. There's a lot of rational things that individuals still can do.
Yeah, and let me give you the last 30 seconds, Dr. Lomborg.
Okay, I would just say Justin's right. We should definitely do what's smart, and insulation is a great idea. We should definitely change our light bulbs, but we also got to realize that's not going to, you know, solve the problem. It's going to go a little way towards solving it. Let's do it. But the big solution to this really requires that we focus much more on research and development. I'm proposing increase that tenfold. It would still be much cheaper than the Kyoto Protocol, and it would actually make a lot more benefit come mid-century.
Thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you.
Bjorn Lomborg is author of Cool It, The Skeptical Environmentalist Guide to Global Warming. Thanks to Carmen Jackson and Karen Prager for producing the hour. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network.